Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hey there, it's Chris Bentley, host of Here and Now Anytime. Let me ask you a quick favor. It's easy, but important to me and everyone who works on this show. If you like that we're here every afternoon, bringing you fresh perspectives and insightful conversations on the big stories of the day, take 5 seconds and follow Here and Now Anytime, wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. And if you want to make us really happy and help other people find this show, leave us a good review. It really helps. And thanks. Now here's the show.
The message is very simple. Unless we and our Palestinian neighbors will find a formula, a political formula, to live together, we will both die together.
Iran's attack on Israel got the world's attention. But inside Israel, deadly violence in the occupied West Bank rages on. It's Tuesday, April 16th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, 1 year after the start of a civil war in Sudan, refugees living in the U.S. fear for their families back home. Also, the NBA playoffs are starting, but after women's basketball's breakout year, are more eyes on the new stars of the WNBA?
Caitlin Clark, Andrew Reese have done so much for the game of women's basketball, and I'm not talking just their colleges, I'm talking about in general. And yeah, we'll continue to see that trend going forward with the likes of Juju Watkins out in USC and other young talented players on the rise.
First, though, Israel's war cabinet met today, again, to weigh possible responses to Iran's missile and drone attack over the weekend. We wanted to get a better sense of public opinion and political calculations inside Israel regarding Iran. So we called up Alon Pincus in Tel Aviv. He's a writer and former Israeli diplomat who served under several prime ministers. Here's his conversation with Scott Tong.
What is the mood you sense inside Israel after last weekend's attack? We do know there are very diverse communities there.
No, obviously, I was just going to say, just like there's no average American, there's really no average Israeli. Israelis have been devastated and feel vulnerable and feel agonized ever since October 7th. Then came this adventure with Iran. And, you know, and people used sort of a lot of black humor about this because, to be fair, it didn't come out of the blue. The Iranians were threatening for 10 days to do so. And in the last week, there were growing signs, public signs, and they didn't know what to expect. But people did know that something is imminent. And then you have, you know, a small, tightly knit society with all due differences between the different groups. Rumors start to spread. It's going to be Saturday. No, it's going to be Sunday. And it tested people's nerves and anxieties to a limit that I haven't seen before. Here was an act of war from a country far away, and people feel exposed and vulnerable. There's no question about that. On top of which, let me add just one more observation here. They feel bad about Israeli intelligence and how the Israeli IDF performed on the 7th of October. Then you have, you know, the pundits, the critics. They're saying, look, the Iranian policy right now is being managed by a bunch of people who are shell-shocked from October 7th. So how could we trust their good judgment and prudence? And that applies to the question that everyone is asking right now, whether or not Israel is going to retaliate over the retaliation.
Alon, you know, you're the third Israeli I've spoken to who mentioned, you know, on that long Saturday night, early Sunday morning, people turning to dark humor, gallows humor, right, as a coping mechanism to just get through it. I don't want to make light of anything, but, you know, some people posted, oh, first direct flights from Iran to Israel since 1979, you know, dark humor.
We all engaged in that.
If we're all gonna, if we're going to be up all night, we may as well start the Passover Seder. Help us understand this as, you know, as a coping mechanism.
Well, it's exactly that, Scott. It's a coping mechanism. Okay, if you're sitting in an apartment in Tel Aviv or in Haifa or in any other place, and you sense that there is something coming, and you know there's absolutely nothing you could do about it, and it is a coping mechanism, because the next day, streets were empty, and, you know, and people stayed home. By Sunday night, you couldn't find a place in a restaurant, cafe, or bar.
But just to make sure I understand you, do you sense that, at least for a number of Israelis, there's a sense of security that was pierced Saturday night? Is that fair to say?
Yes. I think it was pierced on October 7th. With this Iran thing, it was further pierced. Now, look, people are very proud about the successful interception of most of those drones, cruise missiles, and surface-to-surface missiles. But let's not forget, this was defensive. It was not offensive, which is why that triggered the immediate natural response. Let's hit them back. Now, you know, professionals talk about restoring deterrence. The average guy in the street wants just to feel good about this. That, yeah, we could still do things. That, yeah, we could still defend ourselves by attacking, not by defending. But people also understand that escalation could be a horrendous thing. Mm.
Finally, Alon, and thank you for all these observations. The war in Gaza continues. Israel hit a mosque in northern Gaza. And in the occupied West Bank, Israeli settlers have attacked Palestinians after an Israeli teen was killed there. From where you sit in Tel Aviv, how are people following this? Or are they following all this?
Well, that's a very good question, because one of the complaints that the international community had toward Israel, and one of the complaints that people like me had throughout the last 6 months, is that in their natural rage and very predictable, want of revenge and vengeance, Israelis were completely oblivious to what's going on in Gaza. The same applies, per your question, Scott, the same applies to the West Bank. They just conveniently shrug it off and say, yeah, well, that's not the important thing right now. While it should be, because if you have a front in Gaza, a front with Iran, a potential front with Hezbollah in Lebanon, the last thing you want is another front opening in the West Bank, which is Israel's longest border, essentially. Conveniently ignoring these realities is not a good thing.
Alon Pincus is a writer, former Israeli diplomat, joining us from Tel Aviv. Alon, always good to have you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Scott. Anytime.
Well, we are not conveniently ignoring those realities, as Alon Pincus put it. So let's turn now to a story that got somewhat overshadowed this weekend in the occupied West Bank. After a 14-year-old Israeli shepherd went missing near Ramallah on Friday, his body was found the next day. Then hundreds of armed Israeli settlers raided Palestinian villages near Ramallah, setting fire to homes and cars in what's considered the biggest settler rampage since the war in Gaza began. Three Palestinians were killed. Dror Etkes is the Israeli founder of Kerem Navot, an organization that monitors and researches Israeli land policy in the West Bank. And he told Robin Young, violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians has been on the rise.
In the last half a year, we have seen things which we haven't seen before, including attacks against Palestinian, especially Palestinian herding communities in area, in order to depopulate these communities. We're looking at around 30 communities which had been depopulated in the last 2 years. Most of them, 24 out of them, had been depopulated in the last half a year since October 7th.
So these are Palestinian communities that have been depopulated, as you said. And the way you are saying it and the fact that you're tracking it tells us that this is something that's concerning to you as an Israeli. And we want to underscore it. Many Israelis condemn the settler movement. They call it provocative. But Prime Minister Netanyahu backs this movement. So just tell us, how does the Israeli army handle a rampage like the one that was reported over the weekend given that the prime minister backs the settlers, what did they do this time? Did they try to tamp it down?
It goes back to the beginning of Israeli occupation of the West Bank in 1967. The Israeli military is a major player, or a necessary player in this whole story. And obviously nothing could happen in the West Bank without the tolerance and in many, many cases also the support of Israeli military. So it's not necessarily the official stand. It's not where the commanders of the military would necessarily say, you know, that they support it. Of course not. But you can actually see Israeli soldiers standing next to settlers who are attacking Palestinians, who are burning property, who are shooting Palestinians or shooting Palestinians' homes. Yeah. And again, nothing could and would happen without the support of Israeli military in the West Bank. Mm. That includes, of course, the establishment of these outposts where these settlements are coming from. This includes, of course, handing these settlers weapons.
You're saying that the settlers are actually receiving what looks like military items.
Of course. I mean, every rifle which every settler in the West Bank is carrying comes from the military. And I think that there's another important thing here to mention, and this is the total, absolute lack of law enforcement in the West Bank, okay? This is a jungle. This is basically a jungle.
Well, to your point, and we can't verify that in the moment, but we know that, especially in light of the Israeli army turning its attention to Gaza, settlers are far more, not just policing themselves, but policing Palestinians?
What happened after October 7th is that at once thousands of Israeli settlers had been recruited, and at once these settlers suddenly became soldiers in the West Bank, right? So these settlers, which were yesterday the neighbors, you know, not very nice neighbors of these Palestinians, now suddenly became the policemen and the soldiers who can police, who have the authority, the official authority to police the Palestinians in the West Bank. So the rise of the settlers' violence in the West Bank is directly related to the fact that thousands of Israeli settlers are now recruited to the military and are serving as reservists in the military.
Well, given everything you're saying, the tensions in the West Bank between the settlers and the Palestinians, the war against Hamas in Gaza, we know that the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank is the more moderate PLO. But how has the push from one side, from the settlers, and watching the war in Gaza, how has that, if it has, shifted the thinking in the West Bank? Because we understand many more Palestinians there are now, you know, eyeing Hamas, the militaristic group.
When I speak with Palestinians, the main message which I hear from them is the understanding that the current Israeli government is decisive to continue and to oppress the Palestinians and to try to get rid from as many as possible of Palestinians who live in this country. The idea behind it is to encourage Palestinians to leave their land, to leave their homes, and to live somewhere else.
And Dror, you are Israeli. What would your message from the ground there be to your government?
I think that the message is very simple. Unless we and our Palestinian neighbors will find a formula, a political formula, to live together, we will both die together. The illusion that Israelis can continue to oppress and to dispossess Palestinians forever, this illusion is exploding in our face in the last almost 7 months.
Dror Edkiss, the Israeli founder of Kerem Navot, the organization that monitors and researches Israeli land policy in the West Bank. Dror, thank you so much.
Sure.
For 6 months, we've been focused on the war in Gaza, and we're going to keep our eye on it, of course. But there's another conflict that we want to turn our attention to after the break. When we return, the war in Sudan through the eyes of one Sudanese-American refugee. Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
One year ago, civil war broke out again in Sudan. The conflict has killed more than 14,000 people so far and created the world's largest displacement crisis, according to humanitarian organizations. Head to NPR.org to find a photo essay and other reflections on a year of war in Sudan. But right now, we're going to consider the story of one man, a Sudanese-American named Yasser. We're not using his last name, as he fears retaliation against his family back home. Yasser came to the U.S. in 1999, fleeing the autocratic regime of Omar al-Bashir, who has since been deposed. But Yasser says the roots of this current conflict were apparent when he fled Sudan decades ago. And now he's worried about his family in the capital, Khartoum. That's where fighting erupted on April 15, 2023, between Sudan's army and an organized militia known as the RSF, or Rapid Support Forces. Here's Yasser's conversation with Deepa Fernandez.
Yasser, this conflict can be really hard for people to understand, and hopefully we'll be able to understand it more through you. But before we get to that, I'd love to learn more about your family there. As I said, you have three siblings, and they live with their families in Sudan. Can you tell me a little more about them?
They used to live peacefully in Khartoum, Sudan, and the war began on April 15, 2023, and that was the situation before the beginning of the war. A month later, they had to flee. Each one had to flee to a different state in Sudan.
So let's try and understand this, because we know this war is now being called the world's largest internal displacement crisis. 8.5 million people have been run out of their homes. So your siblings have had to flee. And when they left, Yasser, you told us they have children. What does that mean when you turn to your children and say, kids, we have to go? You know, how did that happen? What did they take with them? And did they know where they were going?
No, they wouldn't know. Even my brother, he left his car. They just tried to flee. They gone from small city to small city, and then when they reach end of the city, they took a bus from there and they flee to different. One of them, he went to Port Sudan. This is like far north and east of Sudan. And my sister, she went to the north. It's close to Egypt area.
And as they were fleeing, did any of them tell you about what was going on around them? We've heard such horror stories. Did they witness that?
Some people, they stay there and they call them, or they used to contact them. I mean, few days after they left, one of the militias, we heard from the neighbors, they came to our house, they searching everything. They took my brother's cars, same thing for my sister, and all the valuable stuff. Everything has been taken. All the people who live there, they say they have the experience the same problem. Their belongings stolen, their money, their jewelers, cars, everything. The city looks abandoned.
And I want to ask you, Yasser, you are watching all of this from the US. That must have been really hard. It must continue to be really hard.
Yes, unfortunately. And the sad part of it is we don't know when there's going to be end. Now it's complete 1 year. The kids is away from the school 1 year now, and they don't know when they're going to be back.
And then in September of last year, your brother was abducted by the RSF. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, he was trying to flee from the city he was in, from his house, with his family, because he couldn't take it anymore. And arrived support forces called RSF, one of the militia, their fightings. They stopped him. They took his phone and they read all the WhatsApps, all the media in there. And they took him as a hostage when they knew he has some relative brothers in US and in Europe. They asked about a ransom to be paid. So we had to negotiate with them for a couple of weeks.
So you were involved in the negotiation to release your brother?
Yes. I was committed with them with WhatsApp, and also we have a brother who's living in England. So sometimes with me, sometimes with him, we get different calls. We had to gather that money. Also, when he released, he was not in a good health condition. He was being tortured. He still have marks on his face, on his head, hands. He's still suffering from that.
You shared some pictures with us, and it's so hard to see. I can't imagine. He's your brother. What did that feel like as you were negotiating?
It was a hard one, and we didn't tell them, but we didn't have any options. I mean, killing a person for them is like nothing. It's like drinking water for them. So we were afraid that something could be happened to him. It was a nightmare, a couple of weeks, nightmares. But yeah, it went okay, finally. It's not okay, but it's better than the worst case scenario.
Is there any way you can get your siblings out of the country? Have you tried?
Unfortunately, all of Egypt used to be the easiest way to go. But now they close the border and it's hard to go to Egypt now. So at this time, it's hard to go anywhere for them.
I'm wondering if you can help us understand who these two sides are. And I know that when you fled Sudan in 1999, the Janjaweed, which was a group that terrified the region of Darfur, that was on the rise. Today, the Rapid Support Forces, which is one side in this conflict, the RSF, they look to be a rebranded version of the Janjaweed. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Rapid Support Forces is just a nickname or a spoiled name for them. They are just really a Janjaweed, the one who kills 300,000 people in Darfur. They are doing the same thing now in Khartoum, just killing people left and right, kidnapping, raping, anything they do.
And some have said that it was Omar al-Bashir's policies, the dictator that you fled, that led to the rise of the Janjaweed, now the RSF. And I'm wondering if there's any roots of today's conflict that can be pinned back to Omar al-Bashir.
Yeah, al-Janjaweed, that's their real name. I don't like to call them Arabic support forces because there is no support they're doing. They're just killing left and right, as I said. They were created by Omar al-Bashir. And that's one of the strategies he was doing. He was separating the power of the army to be scattered in different powers. Janjaweed, one side, the Sudanese army forces, one side, and there was another militia, and there were too many militias. So that's his strategy to be in power, to separate the powers of one entity.
Yeah, sir. I wonder if you feel like the international community is doing anything or doing enough. The Biden administration is calling on countries to stop arming the warring sides in Sudan. There have been peace talks, multiple attempts that have collapsed. What should the world be doing right now?
I need all the world to come together, the United Nations, and through the United States, to stop the war there. If and it's obviously negotiation with two parties involved is not going anywhere and will be on and on and on. So the only option I can see from my side, because I know very well the situation there, it's not going anywhere, just people suffering and suffering. So they can do the United Nations Chapter 7 to come by force to stop the war in Sudan.
So I'd love it, you know, as we end, mm-hmm. if you could leave us with a thought. When people talk about Sudan, what do you think the broader public isn't understanding about what's happening there to people like your brother and sister and their families?
So the people in Sudan living miserable lives now, and I encourage all people internationally to come together and help people in Sudan. They are really in need. More than 30,000 being killed. Health situation is going worse and worse. No medical equipment, no medicine, nothing. Kids away from schools. And this is a crisis. And I hope that all the world come together and help the people of Sudan.
Yasser, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Coming up, Robin previews the NBA playoffs and reviews the WNBA draft picks. Hoop Dreams after the break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why accessibility is central to Betterment's mission.
The real innovation for Betterment was taking a set of tools that were used by the ultra wealthy and making them accessible to the average investor. And that includes tax strategies, that includes dollar cost averaging. These are all sort of tricks of the trade.
Learn more about automated investing technology at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit their website to get a quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. Then just choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
The NBA's play-in tournament tips off tonight. It's that slightly convoluted mini-tournament that decides who plays the teams already through to the playoffs. They're having a rest. The Western Conference games are tonight. Stars like LeBron James and Steph Curry will try to keep their seasons alive. Oh, yes, in women's basketball, the WNBA draft was last night. Gee, I wonder who was first overall.
The Indiana Fever select Caitlin Clark, University of Iowa.
Surprise! We're joined by NBA columnist and Boston University lecturer A. Sherrod Blakely. And Sherrod, we want to start with the men's, though, the play-in tournament. How does it work for those uninitiated, and how are people feeling about it, you know, 4 years in now?
Well, let's just go through the format. First off, the number 7 and 8 seeded teams play each other. The winner will then become the official number 7 seed, and that team will play the number 2 seed.
Okay.
The loser of the 7-8 game will then play the winner of the 9-10 game. And the winner of that game will be the 8th and final playoff seed.
I need a whiteboard.
Yeah, there's a certain flow chart dynamic that you have to kind of follow to keep along with it. But the bottom line is this year in particular, the play-in games have a little bit more star power than usual. When you talk about LeBron James, you talk about Steph Curry, right. You know, and over in the East, you've got Joel Embiid and Jimmy Butler among those playing in the play-in game. So it has a little bit more sex appeal to it this year than past years. But overall, people like what they've seen, especially when you look at a team like the Miami Heat that went all the way to the they went very deep into the playoffs a year ago after beginning in a play-in game.
Well, and kids love it too because it's exciting. They're at a tournament. They have no idea. It's this play-in thing. It's fun. But speaking of exciting, Caitlin Clark, number one overall in last night's WNBA draft, a lovely gala capping an amazing week where she's also going to appear on Saturday Night Live. Her new team, the Indiana Fever, they'll be nationally broadcast a lot. We're also hearing she's been offered something like $76,000 compared to the millions men get. Is it thought that that will rise as she rises the league? Well,
the league itself has to rise. And that $76,000 that you mentioned, that's the salary that's slotted for where she was drafted. And obviously over time that will increase. But the thing that Caitlin and a lot of, I think, the WNBA players are realizing is the power that they have beyond that base salary. You know, when you look at the NBA players, they make a lot of money, obviously, with base salaries, but most of them make more money outside of the game. And Caitlin will be no different in that regard. But yeah. I do anticipate as time moves on, you'll start seeing that rookie salary scale, which is what we're talking about with Caitlin. You'll see that increase. Will it be at the level of the men's game? Who knows? But it will definitely be trending in the right direction as that goes.
We have to mention other stars who went high last night. Cameron Brink, who starts high. She's like 9 feet tall. She went to the LA Sparks, Angel Reese to Chicago. Women who are now household names. I mean, you think we're going to start to see this big shift?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that more than anything else, this is what happens when opportunity presents itself and you have the right people at the right time making the right impact that goes beyond just the X's and O's and wins and losses. Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese have done so much for the game of women's basketball. And I'm not talking just their colleges. I'm talking about in general. And we'll continue to see that trend going forward with the likes of Juju Watkins out in USC and other young talented players on the rise.
NBA columnist and Boston University lecturer A. Sherrod Blakely, thank you so much.
No problem.
That's it for us today. This show comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Shirley Jihad, Sam Rafelson, Gabrielle Healy, and Thomas Danielian. Our editors are Todd Munt, Ahmad Daman, Peter O'Dowd, Micaela Rodriguez, Michael Scotto, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor E-Trade from Morgan Stanley. Take control of your financial future with E-Trade. No matter what kind of investor you are, their tools and resources can help you be ready for what's next. Now, when you open an account, you can get up to $1,000 with a qualifying deposit. Terms apply. Learn more at etrade.com/NPR. Investing involves risks. Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, LLC. Member SIPC. E-Trade is a business of Morgan Stanley.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we have very important people on our show and then ask them about very unimportant things. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
We are also reliably informed that among your enthusiasms, in addition to macroeconomic policy, is mobile games.
There's some truth in that.
There's some truth in that.
Join us for the NPR podcast that considers all the other things. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.